So today, last time we looked at the we had a brief overview, brief introduction, and we looked at the Indus Valley civilization and some of the problems associated with it. And today we're going to move on to the Vedas and Vedic culture. So the Veda is foundational to Hindu traditions, and there are a number of issues and problems related to this body of text generated by these texts. There are text historical questions concerning the development of these texts. There's problems about the structure of them and how they're related to each other, and what the texts tell us about the societies that compose them. So lots of questions. Now, what can be found in later Hinduism is arguably present here in the Vedas in an incipient form, but there are problems about who composed them and what kind of society they lived in. And there are also theological and philosophical questions about the claimed sources of the texts, about the cosmology they present, about the rituals they describe, and the meanings of the stories that they tell. And so there are text historical approaches, if you like, and also philosophical or theological approaches that you can take to this material. So these two approaches are in many ways quite distinct and sometimes even antithetical to each other. Text historical questions have been concerned about the past primarily, and theological and philosophical questions are concerned about what the text says to us today. And in one sense, all texts are equal regardless of their chronology. So, as Paul Ricoeur says, all texts are equal to the reader in a sense, regardless of their history. Now, according to tradition, the foundations of Hindu Dharma were laid out by the ancient sages or the rishis who saw and promulgated the Vedic scriptures according to the tradition. And Vedic tradition, or Vedism, as Histamine refers to it, has had a deep hold on Indian thought and imagination to the present. And in spite of being superseded by the temple cult, devotional or bhakti movements, and tantric scriptures and traditions, it is still nevertheless terribly important. Hello. That's okay. Come in, Keshav. We're just looking at the Vedas today. There we are.
Thank you.
So we're just sort of going through this handout. As a scholar called Madeleine Biardo, she wrote actually quite a good book on Hinduism called The Anthropology of a Civilization. She was a French structuralist. And Biardo has traced the tenacity of the Veda in Hinduism, if you like, in the history of Hinduism, particularly in the Mahabharata, up to her field work of a god called Potu Raja. And now for her, for Madeleine Biardo, all of Hinduism is based on the model of Vedic sacrifice. So this morning I want to examine Vedic sacrifice, introduce the texts that describe and legitimate it, namely the Vedas, and introduce interpretations and extensions of those texts, particularly in the Upanishads. So let's look at the Vedas first of all. The Veda is regarded by some Hindus as timeless revelation, and it is not regarded as of human origin or human authorship. It's aparushya, not of human origin. And it's regarded as being eternal and containing all knowledge. Now, while others regard the text as a revelation of God, so there are different views. Some Hindus think it's authorless, has no author, and some Hindus think that God is its author. Now, traditionally, the Veda has been seen by the rishis, or the sages that I mentioned earlier, who communicated it to the human community and it was formulated according to tradition by Vyasa in its present form, by the redactor, Vyasa. And from the perspective of the believer, the Veda is timeless revelation, yet from the text's historical perspective, it was compiled over a very long period of time and reflects different periods of social and religious development. The two perspectives are not, of course, necessarily incompatible. The term text, or indeed canon, in the Indian context implies an oral tradition passed down with meticulous care and accuracy through the generations. The priestly class of Vedic Aryans, the Brahmins, were and continue to be the preservers of this tradition. And indeed, the Veda was not written down for some thousand years after its composition. And the very act of writing was considered, according to one text called a Brahmana, as a polluting activity. So writing, you could do business. I mean, writing was for business, but for the sacred act of transmitting the Veda, that had to be oral, and that couldn't be written down, because writing is polluting. And the Veda, then, is the foundation of most later developments in Hinduism. Now, the word itself means knowledge and is cognate with the English word wit, witness, and the German Wissen. And this vast body of text contains ritual formula, poetry, and explanations of ritual, and does include some early kinds of philosophy. And this Vedic corpus is intimately connected with ritual or sacrifice, and the primary purpose of the text seems to be a ritual one. Now, one of the primary distinctions that the Vedic tradition has made for its own scriptures is between mantra, which are verses used in ritual, which make up the collection of the text called Sanghita, and Brahmana, text for ritual exegesis. So the indigenous distinction is between mantra, which are the verses of the text recited during ritual, and Brahmana, the interpretation of those verses, or ritual exegesis. Now, the structure of the text itself, of the Veda, the word Veda is used in two senses. One is a synonym for revelation or Shruti. Shruti means that which is heard. In Sanskrit, you've got various systems of transliteration, which perhaps I should explain. Because you've got 48-49 letters in the Sanskrit alphabet, you've got more letters than English can cope with, so they've devised a system of transliteration. So there are sibilants, sa, the one like that, the yes with a line above it and yes with a dot underneath it, both of those are roughly pronounced sha. There's a difference, but for our purposes it doesn't make any difference. Sha. So Shiva is written like that. Or you might see Shiva written Shiva. This is the more scholarly way. The other words we're going to come across are ends with the retroflex, ends with a dot underneath it, which is a na. A dot above an n, which is a ng. Hey, come in. And a na. So you've got different nasal sounds, but we'll come across these in due course. Yeah, I'll give you a. Hang on, there's a whole load.
Where is the dot above the N?
It's that yeah. Like an NG, something like that.
Yeah. How does a C become a cat crunch? How does a C become a ch?
I'll tell you in a minute.
Sorry.
C becomes a. So you should have four sheets altogether.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And
sorry, I lost the lecture, wouldn't let us leave, so.
Oh, it's alright, no problem. So anyway, we're just going through this handout really, and so, but we were having sort of a timeout thing for an explanation of these different sounds. I mean, you'll know all this, but what was that question?
I'm so sorry, C, how does it have a dot somewhere to make it a ch?
No.
I didn't think it did, but that's why I couldn't understand how it happens when I look up in Monier Williams.
A dot. Oh yeah. Oh, that. Oh, that's because he does that for a shot.
Oh, busy. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my.
How does kakra become chakra?
Chakra. It was never kakra. It was always chakra. It's just that the k is.
He's always a ch. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Apologies. Thank you.
So that what's a c is a sort of a ch. Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay, the structure of the text, we've on this sheet, we've done the structure of the text. The Veda, so far, we said that it's timeless revelation, it's regarded as timeless revelation by the Hindu tradition. And there are two senses. One is the general sense of the whole body of texts, including the early collections, right the way through to the Upanishads, that the whole what's called Shruti, or that which is heard, the whole revelation, but also more narrowly the first four layers of the text. The Sanhita is regarded as the Veda. So on this diagram you've got the structure of the text there. Sanhita means collection. And you've got four collections. You've got the Rig, the Yajur, the Sama, and the Atharva. And the next layer down, which is composed at a later period, is called the Brahmanas, the Brahmana texts, which are theological and ritual commentary. The next layer after that are called the Aranyakas, forest texts. Aranya is forest or wilderness texts, as opposed to the Grama, the village, or the
what does wilderness refer to?
Probably the idea that these texts were composed in the wilderness and were about the stage of life where you go into the forest.
Okay.
And then finally the Upanishads, the secret philosophy, the interpretation, the esoteric interpretation of the earlier material. Chronological layers, yeah. So in a sense, the Rig Veda is the oldest. So if this is a timeline, it should be a kind of slightly diagonal, I suppose, the Sanhita. So the Rig is the oldest, then the Yajur and the Sama, and probably the Atharva in that order, chronological order. Some of the Rig Veda is recapitulated in the Sama Veda. So the Rig Veda is a collection of 10 books. Collection, Sanhita simply means collection. And those books are called mandalas of 1,028 hymns to different gods. And they're composed in Vedic Sanskrit from as early as 1200 BCE. And they were composed over a period of several hundred years. Now, the Sama Veda is a book of songs. Sama means a song. It's based on the Rig Veda, but with instructions for their recitation. So the Rig Veda is the basic hymns, if you like. The Sama Veda is how to sing them. And the Yajur Veda is a collection of short prose formula used in ritual. And of the Yajurveda, there are two major recensions that we have. One is called the black and one's called the white. The Shukla and the Krishna. And you can read all of this in there's a good summary by Michael Witzel in the Black Moor Companion to Hinduism. He's got a diagram there, and it's a very good summary of all of this. And the Atharva Veda is a collection of hymns and magic formula compiled around 900 BC. Although some of the material in the Atharva probably goes back to the age of the Rig Veda. And this has traditionally been considered as inferior, the Atharva, to the other three Sanghitas. And these texts were learned by heart through the generations in different branches of or family lineages, shakas, different branches. So the Rig Veda was transmitted in a branch called the Sakalya branch, while other ascensions have been lost. And perhaps one of the most remarkable things about this literature is that it's been orally transmitted with hardly any change for 3,000 years. An accuracy enabled by a system of double checking, namely the continuous recitation called the Sanghita Patta, in which the Sanskrit rules for combining words operated, and the recitation of the text without this ritual combination called the Pada Patta. So you've got, as indeed there still are, particularly in the Nambudri Brahmins in Kerala, and also Brahmins in somewhere in Bengal, I think. I can't remember, I'll have to check that out. But they learn the text, the Rig Veda and the Sama Veda, off by heart, and they still do. It's incredible to watch them teaching the kids this. And they learn it twice. They learn it once in Sanskrit, you join all the words up together. So they learn it once with the words separated, and then again with all the words joined up together, so you can have a double checking system to make sure that this is accurate. Witzel says it's like listening to a 3,000-year-old tape recording, which is quite interesting. So let's have an example of this. It's from Fritz Stahl's Rules Without Meaning, which I've given you there. You've got, the immortal goddess has pervaded the wide space, the depths and the heights, which is recited in two versions, one in the continuous flow, Ova pra amartya nivato devi udvataha, and the word for word recitation, a uru apra amartya nivataha devi udvataha. So you'd learn it twice like that. I've got a recording of these Nambudri Brahmins reciting the text, so I think I'll bring it in if I can find something to play it on. It's one of these old cassettes. Now, the dating of the text is difficult, but the earliest texts of the Rig Veda were contemporary with a text called Mitanni of northern Syria or Iraq. Now, the Mitanni culture was around 1450 to 1350 BC. So the Rig Veda is sort of cognate with that kind of time frame, really. Contemporary with that, with the Mitanni culture. Now, the Mitanni texts mention the gods found in the Veda, such as Varuna, Mitra, Indra, Nasatya, and they're all found in the Mitanni texts. And the texts, according to Witzel, predate the Rig Veda. But there is no absolute dating, although we can say that the use of iron is recorded in a post-Rigvedic text, the Atharva Veda, at about 1200-1000 BC. And they also predate the Buddha, who is dated now about 400 BC, whose death is about 410. Although some Upanishads are arguably post-Buddhist. But they also predate the grammatical commentary of Patanjali, who's 150 BC, and his predecessor Panini, who quotes the Vedic texts. You can read about this dating in Witzel's article. So we can date these texts. If we know the date of the Mitanni texts, and Witzel's argument is that I can't remember the reasons, but the Rig Veda is later than the Mitanni text, just a bit later, but not very much. And so we can date the Rig Veda in relation to the Mitanni text. Now, the Rig Veda is a voluminous corpus of text, which is, as I say, more than 2,000 years old, possibly 3,000 years old, and it deals with sacrifice, particularly the prose texts or the Brahmanas, and the later edition called the Shrauta Sutras. And the Shrauta Sutras were texts... I should have put this down, but after Upanishads, you should have sutras. Now, sutras are not regarded as revelation. They're regarded as of human authorship or smriti, but they follow from the structure of the Veda. So a later distinction was between shruti and smriti. Smriti means remembrance or remembered text, and shruti is the text which were heard. So smriti is secondary revelation, really, as in this, our text is divinely inspired, if you like, but of human authorship. So the sutras are regarded as smriti, but also the great epics are regarded as smriti, but above all the law books, the smritis, are regarded as our smriti. So the ritual traditions are in these lineages, and the sutras are guidelines for the practice of which is revealed in the Shruti. Now, the oldest text of the Rig Veda is the Rig Veda, and it's in a stylized ancient kind of Sanskrit. And it contains verses of praise to the Hindu gods and early chiefs. And most of the hymns were intended to be recited during the annual Soma ritual, celebrated at the time of the new year. And it was composed before the use of iron over a period of 4 or 5 generations under the Puru and Bharata chieftains, especially the great Bharata king Sudas. Now, the hymns were composed by various clans of poets whose names we know through the later tradition, and through their names being interwoven in the poetry they use, a bit like Mozart putting his name in the composition. So these poets wove their names into their hymns, into their poetry.
What's a Soma ritual?
The Soma is, I still compose sometimes, it's a big annual ritual which involves various sacrifices, which I'll describe. Yeah, I think we'll go on to Soma. Let's have a look. Yeah, well, I'll talk about Soma in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, so the power of these poems, the hymns were composed by various clans, and they also, the power of speech is terribly important, Vach, in these texts. Most of the hymns are connected to the sacrifice, although some are simple poetry, and there's some proto-philosophy as well, and cosmological speculation. And central to the Rig Veda is the power of speech, Vach, which expresses Ritta. Now, Ritta is a forerunner of the term Dharma. Ritta can be translated as cosmic order, but also virtue. And, virtue, really. That which is correct behaviour. And it's the power which upholds the world and the order of the universe. And it keeps human society functioning correctly. And in contrast to Ritta, Niriti is the disappearance or the destruction of order and the destruction of truth.
Sorry, what was that word?
Niriti. I haven't got it written down there. That look with the dot is pronounced something like really Niriti. So Ritta is truth. So Niriti is is destruction. The destruction of truth is the order. And this Ritta is facilitated through Brahman, through the power that allows its formulation. So there's a power underlying Ritta. Ritta is virtue or world order, and the power underlying that is Brahman, which becomes very big in the Upanishads, this idea of that which underlies everything. So originally it's the power which upholds Ritta, virtue. And it's also the power which upholds the sacrifice, it's the power of the sacrifice.
Brahman, you say?
Yes, yes. And this power of correctly stated truth is found in the later tradition, so Satya Kriya, the act of truth. And it's also found in other European cultures. So it's the idea that your highest power is the power of your word, of your speech. So Brahman is the power that allows the formulation of Vaj, which expresses Ritta. And that becomes big in the Upanishads, as we'll see. Now, Vedic ritual, the central religious practice of the Vedic Aryans was sacrifice and sharing the sacrificial meal with others and with the gods, with the devas. Now, through sacrifice, the gods were appeased and favours won, such as sons and cattle. And the social standing of the sacrificer, the person who instigated and paid for the rite, is elevated. Scholar Stephanie Jameson has observed that Vedic ritual is the ideally portable religion because it requires no fixed places of worship and no images or texts to be carried around. So the texts are recited orally, so you don't have to have the text with you. And you don't need anything. You just need you construct the sacred space with wood or whatever. So it was ideal for these sort of itinerant nomads. So it's argued who entered and spread across the northern plains of India. Now the term sacrifice is homa or yajna. Sorry, I didn't have that there. Yajna is usually pronounced gya, yagya, yajna, yagya. And it refers not only to animal sacrifice, but to any offering into the fire, such as milk, clarified butter, curds, grains, and the soma plant. So although, in later tradition, yajna refers mainly to vegetarian offerings into the fire. But in this early period, it was... mainly goats were sacrificed, cattle, sheep, and horses. And the fire links the world to the divine realm. And according to Heisterman, who wrote a very interesting book called The Broken World of Sacrifice about the early Vedic period, he says that sacrifice is a complex rite that embodies a number of elements, particularly three: killing, destruction, and food distribution. So there's the killing of the animal. There's its destruction in the fire, and there's the distribution of its meat, which has a bonding effect on the community, for Heisterman. Now, for the Vedic ritualist, killing refers not only to animals but to vegetable offerings as well, and the term hanti is used. He kills, han is to kill, hanti, he kills, refers to the also to the pressing of the killing of this plant called soma. The destruction is, so you've got the killing of the thing, you've got the destruction of the thing, which is the portion that's withdrawn from the human consumption. That's the god's portion. And sacrifice is thus linked with the gift and the sacrificial victim can be offered as an atonement or a fulfillment of a vow, tying the gods in with the network of reciprocity. So if you give something to the gods, they've got to give something to you. So there's this reciprocity involved. And destruction is a refusal to consume something. So it's a kind of renunciation. And according to Heisterman, that renunciation involved in the sacrifice is internalized in the Upanishads. Now, there are two kinds of ritual that were developed. One is called the solemn or public ritual, the Shrauta, based on the Shruti, the Shrauta rituals. And the other is the domestic rituals, or the Grihya, and life cycle rituals. Now, the Shrauta, these solemn public rites, are the older of the two kinds, which demand the burning of three fires. So you have three fires which you sacrifice into. And our knowledge of these rites mainly comes from much later Shrauta sutras, but we can assume that some form of Shrauta observance reaches back to the Rig Veda, as the text refers to various kinds of priests involved in ritual performance. Particularly in its account of the horse sacrifice and the soma sacrifice. So the two big sacrifices are the soma sacrifice, which occurs at the new year, and the horse sacrifice. And these Shrauta rites are still performed to this day, particularly by the Nambudri Brahmins of Kerala. Now, according to Heisterman, the sacrificial animal was originally tied to a post and decapitated, although later it was suffocated outside of the ritual enclosure. So there are different ways of killing the animal. But the most important sacrifice was not of an animal, but of a plant called soma. Now, soma was a drink and a plant and a god. And this was prepared from an unknown plant, and there's some dispute about what that plant was, which later became substituted by other plants as Vedic culture expanded into the northern and Gangetic plains. And soma could have been a substitute, according to Witzel, for an Indo-Aryan sacred drink made from fermented honey, like mead. And you get, I mean, in the beaker people in Europe, they're buried in a crouched position with a beaker by their head. And some archaeologists speculate that this beaker was a kind of mead or fermented honey. And Witzel argues that soma was like that. But there are other views as well. There was a wonderful book by Gordon Wasson called Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality. And he said that soma was a hallucinogenic mushroom called Flyagaric. And it's a very interesting book, that, because he matches up the descriptions of soma growing. The Rig Veda is, there's a whole book 10 of the Rig Veda devoted to soma, and it praises soma in wonderful language. It describes how it grows out of the ground without leaves, and it's like the sun shining, and wonderful descriptions of this plant. But nobody knows what it is. But Wasson came up with this idea that it was actually a Flyagaric mushroom. Because it's pressed, it's crushed, and the juice that comes out of it, he argues, was this hallucinogenic drink. Another scholar, Flatterly, argued that actually it wasn't a hallucinogenic mushroom, but ephedra, which is an amphetamine drink. And there's probably a case for that, because they found in Iran, they found pots with ephedra in the bottom of them. So it could have been a feature, because soma in Iran becomes hayoma in the Avestan tradition. So they have soma rituals as well. So we don't know what it is really, but it was probably some intoxicating, some inspiring drink. So it's these warriors in the Rig Veda, Indra, the warrior god, is always drinking soma, and he becomes immortal. He becomes full of strength and power once he's drunk soma. So it's probably, it could be a phaedra. Because if it's a hallucinogenic drink, they're probably not feeling like that, full of power. So the horse sacrifice, sorry, the soma sacrifice is probably the most important ritual, which occurred once a year. But as the Aryans moved into the Gangetic plains, into the northern plains of India, they lost the source of soma, so what they call soma substitutes, pratinidhi, gets to replace the soma itself. So soma substitutes are used to this day in the soma ritual. The other important sacrifice was the horse sacrifice, which could have been a very old Indo-European rite, and there are reflections of this in Irish monks who wrote about a horse sacrifice in the pagan days, in the ancient pagan days. So it could have been cognate with this or related to this Vedic horse sacrifice. Now, the Shrauta rituals are the earliest that we have a record of, as far as I know, in the world. There could be ancient rites in China recorded, but I think the rituals of the Rig Veda are the very oldest in the world that we have a record of. And they're also the most complex and most elaborate rites, which tied in ritual performance with language. So you get all these theories of ritual developed in anthropology particularly, and none of them take any notice of the Vedic material, which is absurd, because here you've got the oldest tradition that we know of in the world having a record of a very elaborate and ornate ritual, and also an indigenous account of it, a self-description of why they're doing and what they're doing. And all that literature gets completely ignored by anthropology generally. So you can't build a general theory of ritual without taking into account the Indian material. So anyway, sacrifice was, according to this tradition, was believed to have existed from all eternity. And even the creation of the cosmos itself was regarded as a sacrifice. So in the Rig Veda 10:90, you get this giant called this Purusha, the giant man, who is sacrificed to the gods. And different parts of his body form the universe. And different parts of his body form society. So the Brahmins come out of his mouth, the voice of society. The Kshatriyas, the warriors, come out of his arms, the strength of society. The commoners or the Vaishyas come from his thighs, the support of society. And the Shudras, the servants, come from his feet. I suppose that's which society stands on. So the idea that the social body was linked in with the cosmos, was part of the natural order. So what is this sacrifice? Returning to that for a minute, what's sacrifice about? And I've given you a list of various ideas here. Sacrifice was performed to produce results, i.e. propitiation of a god or prosperity in this world and the next. There's also the idea in the Brahmanas that the existence of the universe depends upon the performance of the sacrifice. So if you don't sacrifice, the sun won't rise in the morning. So you have to sacrifice to keep the world going.
Not literally every day.
Yeah, in the Brahmas, not the domestic sacrifice. The big Shrauta sacrifices only occur at certain periods in the year.
What was the domestic sacrifice called?
The Grihya. Grihya.
How do you spell that?
Grihya.
Okay.
The same people generally have to do their domestic sacrifice for the sun to rise the next day.
Yeah, the Brahmanas. No, not everybody. It's the Brahmins. Brahmanas. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it could be just a rhetoric, of course, whether people really believed it, but it's certainly the Brahmanas say that. But it keeps the show on the road, as it were.
Right.
And the power of the sacrifice, which is called Brahman, came to be understood as a being greater than the gods. So the power of the sacrifice was greater than the gods to whom the sacrifice was offered. And it's the power which connects the sacrifice to the cosmic order. That's the early use of that word. And sacrifice is identified with heat, tapas, which later became identified with the heat of asceticism. So you stand on one leg for 12 years and you create tapas, you create inner heat. And people do, they still do. You take a vow not to stand on one leg for 12 years, and you lie in a hammock, you rest in a hammock like that.
Literally?
Yeah, literally. Yeah. Or not to sit down. So people tie their legs up like this, or they swap legs, tie them like that, and they lean in a hammock. They walk around, of course, but the legs get swollen up. But I don't think it's any shame. If you actually decide not to continue that vrata, that observance, you can put your legs down.
What's the point?
Hmm?
Why?
Oh, to get power. And great esteem, great social esteem as well.
Right.
To get spiritual power. To develop an iron will, I suspect. Now, heat, tapas, is also in some texts the origin of the cosmos and the power of living forms, is the power of Indra and the power of ascetics and yogins. Fourthly, sacrifice is performed by priests on behalf of a householder called the sacrificer, the yajamana, who was accompanied by his wife. And the sacrificial victim is a symbol of the sacrificer. The sacrificer is purified and symbolically reborn in a rite called diksha. So the yajamana and his wife, he went into a kind of sweat lodge, small sweat lodge, before the soma sacrifice, for example. And was purified for a number of weeks before the sacrifice. So he shouldn't have any intimate relations with his wife. He shouldn't eat certain foods. And then he goes into the sweat lodge and he undergoes this diksha, this initiation. And the sacrifice is the key to the symbolic universe of the Veda. And in the categories that form the Vedic Aryan world. And put crudely, we might say that there are three realms of the pure, the everyday, and the sacred, with different social and natural phenomena associated with each of these. So in that diagram, which I've taken from Bruce Lincoln, you've got these three realms, if you like. This is the classification or categorization of the Vedic Aryan tradition. So you've got animal categories, human categories, and geographical categories. So the impure wild animals, the mriga, are regarded as impure, really. You've got the sacred animals, which are sacrificial animals. And then you've got two kinds of sacred animals, a good sacrifice, which is a horse, and a bad sacrifice, which is a dog. Dogs were sometimes sacrificed, but that was regarded as a negative sacrifice, bad sacrifice. And then you get domestic animals in between the two. And in human categories, impure are regarded as the non-Aryans and the outcasts. The Kshatriyas are classified as ordinary, everyday people, and the Brahmins are sacred. And then you've got these geographical divisions, the tribal lands, the homeland of the Aryans, the Aryavarta, and the area of the sacrifice, and later the temple. So there's this general classification. And Bruce Lincoln summarizes the principles of these systems by saying that human beings and the cosmos are homologous, are connected up together, as above, so below sort of thing. That's fairly common in esoteric Western traditions as well. You get this idea. Or Blake, C. see heaven in a wildflower, hold eternity in the grain of your hand, or whatever, grain of sand, I can't remember. Matter is eternal but subject to infinite recombination. That's another important idea in the Vedic tradition, which goes into later philosophy. So there's no beginning to the universe, but the matter which it's composed of is subject to infinite recombinations. And time is infinite, there's no beginning to time. So there's no creatio ex nihilo, there's no creation from nothing here. Change is constant, but the same processes cyclically recur. Now there are problems with some of this material. If we pay attention to the Shrauta rites, we find complex rules without meaning, according to Fritz Stahl. Fritz Stahl argues that these Shrauta rites are terribly complex, and he's tried to analyze the complexity, but they're actually meaningless. The meanings of the rites, what he means by that are that the meanings attributed to the rites in the Brahmanas and the Upanishads and later traditions change. The rites themselves stay the same, but the meanings attributed to them change. So he therefore argues that there's no inherent meaning in the rites themselves. So that they're rules, complex rules, without meaning. So semantics is the wrong way of approaching these traditions, but syntax is the right way of understanding it. So they've got a grammar, they've got rules, but they don't have meaning, he says. So, for example, he takes the Agnihotra, the sacrifice of fire, the Agnichayana, the building up of Agni, piling up of Agni. And in this rite, he says there are 12 soma sequences, each comprising a chant or stotra, a recitation, shastra, soma offerings to the deities drunk by the yajamana. So you get those sequences. And then you get also surrounding or embedding of those different phases of the rite. So these pravargya upasad are different phases of the ritual. I haven't developed this fully in the handout here, but you've got these certain recitations called the pravargya and then the upasad, and then you get a layer of bricks laid down for the soma sacrifice. In the soma sacrifice, an altar is made in the shape of a bird. Can't quite do it, but this is the shape of the soma sacrifice, something like that. It's made of bricks, different layers of bricks. And there are precise rules laid down for how you lay the bricks. And you just have to recite certain mantras according to the laying of the bricks until the altar is built up to about that height. And he said in the building up of this altar, you got, say, the recitation of the Taittiriya Sanghita 5791A, followed by Taittiriya Sanghita 5781A. And if the recitation of both together is B, and the intervening recitations is A, we get the structure BAB. So that's the ritual pattern of recitation that's followed in building up this brick altar. And BAB is a recursive structure. And we get elaborations of this. So when you get recital B, you get embeddings within it. You get BAB, a reversal, if you like, within B. So you get... So that structure BAB, where B is a recitation of, say, text X and Y, and A is the recitation of text L. You could get a further elaboration of B, where L is put into B. If that makes any sense. Sorry, my phone's a. I just have to take this if you don't mind. Hello. That'll be the garage. Sorry, I have to go pick my car up. So B might have other elements included within it. So D, E, F, I've got the example there, D, E, F. So I'd encourage you to read Fritz Stahl's book, Rules Without Meaning, in which he argues that you've got this embedding process. So finally then, you've got problems. Some problems here are that Stahl seems to think that ritual is within a bubble, if you like, an ahistorical bubble without that doesn't change through history, through time. And his argument ignores the power relations between social actors and the broader social context. And you could argue that there's a social function of sacrifice that is missed by Stahl's thesis. And there's also the indigenous categorization involving purity and impurity, and that the ritual as an index of values, which the meaningless argument doesn't take account of. So I'll leave you to think about those problems. So with regard to reading, do read Fritz Stahl's Rules Without Meaning. It's an absolutely fascinating book, if you can. It's also called Mantras, Ritual and Mantras. It's been republished in India as Ritual and Mantras. Heisterman's, the first few chapters of The Broken World of Sacrifice, is an excellent account of sacrifice in the Vedas. Brian Smith's Classifying the Universe is an exposition of the Vedic worldview, really, and all the different systems of association. And Witzel's will give you an overview of the structure of the Vedas and the Upanishads and the text. We haven't really looked at the Upanishads today, but we'll do that next time and the time after. So next time we're going to look at Vedic society and as that develops into the later classical period. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.